today's talk is given by Will Cornforth, a PhD student here at the University of Edinburgh, Geosciences. And his title is Remote Sensing for Practical Forestry, Arboriculture to UAVs. Thanks there. Will majored in chemistry in Toronto, but managed to focus on GIS and remote sensing for the latter part. I'm not sure how he did that, but it's a good trick. But after graduating, he worked for a year at the Institute of Zoology in London, analysing vegetation change in protected nature reserves in Africa and South America, using long-term satellite imagery, about 30 years' worth. He's also worked on a collaborative project between NASA and the IOZ, looking at using radar imagery to map forest health and also coastline movement in Bangladesh and India and Mangrove areas. And this is all before starting his PhD here, which he started at the beginning of last year. And that involves using hyperspectral imagery to look at tree stress, which is primarily needle blight in Scots pine. So we therefore look forward to today's talk, which is already very interesting, and more recently also should serve to review the potential for remote sensing being of use for UK forestry. So over to Will.
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you for having me here. As Aaron said, I'm a PhD student here, but I'm actually based at King's Building, which is the other parts of the university here, so if you're based here, that's why you haven't seen me before. So I'll be talking a bit about remote sensing for more practical uses of forestry, and what do I mean by practical forestry? Well, basically the not important part of forestry, which is the forestry excluding that aspects of carbon dioxide emissions and red and ecosystem services, so everything from planting the tree to harvesting it and management in between. First, before I talk about that, I'll just give a brief introduction to forestry in the UK, or Great Britain specifically. So about 18% of land cover at the moment here in Scotland is woodland. 13% GB-wise, and before most of Britain used to be covered in forests, and gradually over the centuries it's depleted somewhat quite a lot. We have a minimum 4% woodland cover in the country for about two centuries. But the Forestry Commission was born out of the devastation of Great Britain's forests, especially in World War One, where timber was needed for coal mining, for in the east in the pits, and also for trench warfare. So at the end of World War One, Forestry Commission was created, and they were given the task of creating new woodlands in the UK, in Great Britain. And so gradually, woodlands covers gradually increased, especially in the 60s and 70s, when there's quite a lot of planting, unfortunately, on some peatlands, which is probably going to have to be, it's being removed at the moment, but woodlands covers increasing. And about between a quarter and a third of woodland in the UK is owned by the Forestry Commission, is managed by the Forestry, owned and managed by the Forestry Commission. Although the Forestry Commission have some remit on other forests in Great Britain, they're in charge of issuing grants for creation of woodlands, etc. There's a really small amount of semi-natural and ancient woodland in GB. That's very important for habitats, and other than just forestry for economic reasons, semi-natural and ancient woodland is quite important in documenting that. This is also becoming a big task. In terms of the economy, woodland contributes about between 1 and 2 billion, depending on the year, annually, and, 1 to 2 billion pounds annually. And as far as employment, it's about 15,000 people directly employed in the forestry business in GB, and about 40,000 indirectly through jobs such as road making roads for forestry, timber transport, etc. So in Great Britain, this is what wooden cover looks like. It's mostly conifer species, pines and spruces. About 55% pines, Scots pines, and nearly all the spruces are Sitka spruces. Sitka spruce. And we also have many broadleaf species, as oak and ash there on the left. Up there's birch and larch tree as well. This is just a picture of pine on the left here and spruce over here. Before I start talking more about forestry, for those of you aren't familiar with it, when I refer to a stand, it's just a block of trees, normally a contiguous block of trees. So the stand on the right is spruce, stand on the left is pine. So I'll also quickly explain what a forest inventory is. An inventory is just a detailed list or database of what you have. So for the Forestry Commission, they have something called subcompartment database, which is their GIS database of all of Forestry Commission forests. And although it is an incredible database, it's got details on when the stand was planted, when the extent of it, and all of these things. It is actually incredibly inaccurate, and there's huge problems with that. Well, my experience with it and what the forest rangers seem to say as well is got huge problems with it in terms of reliability and accuracy. And because nearly all forestry operations rely or depend on the accuracy of the forest inventory, it can get really frustrating when you end up coming across mistakes. And, another use of the forest inventory like this is when, for example, I'm assuming most of you have heard of the ash dieback disease, Calorifraxinia. The government set the task of making sure nearly all ash stands were surveyed. And the only way you can do this is with something like this, to say exactly where everything is. So previous surveys have been done on a national scale, but then they haven't been associated with geospatial information, and that is essential to making it accessible and useful. So every decade the Forestry Commission does every decade or so, a national inventory of all of the trees they survey different plots in woodlands across the UK, not between 10 and 15,000, I think, or about 10,000, I think, this time they did 15,000. They normally are, 0.01 hectares, 10 by, nationally they're 0.1 hectare plots for the surveys. And for the last survey, which is starting in 2009, they decided, the Forestry Commission, to create a fresh woodland map from aerial imagery. And the main purpose of them doing this was actually for timber forecast, timber production forecast, which is, that was the main reason for doing it, but it's also incredibly useful for lots of other things. So they also, and also when you, they also came up with new sites where they're going to do the surveys, and to do that with statistical accuracy, you need to know exactly what all the woodlands are. The previous national database, or national geospatial GIS layer for woodland, was that provided by the North Ordnance Survey, which is incredibly out of date. So the Forestry Commission doing it's called the National Forestry Inventory. Them doing that has been incredibly useful for national studies. Okay, and also in Scotland, it's been very useful to catalogue areas of native woodland. When you get to do a survey of woodland, it's very, very difficult if you don't already have a map of where the woodland is, because when you get to a forest, you have no idea how big it is, whether it's homogenous or... it's very difficult to survey things properly that way. So, in Scotland, they're creating a GIS layer of all of the purple layers. The purple polygons are Caledonian pinewood forests, and they also created a layer to show areas where they think they can essentially expand native woodland coverage to, and that shows up here in orange. But they can only do this with the National Forest Inventory. So that was done using really basic aerial imagery, most of it airborne, collected airborne. So there's nothing special in the type of remote sensing for this use. I'll go on now to talk a bit about silvicultural systems. So basically, the two, if you were to split to silvicultural systems, types of silvicultural systems into, you have clear felling and continuous cover forestry, CCF. Clear felling is a very simple cycle where you start with a planting, goes on to management, which is just normally clear weed removal. So if you have rhododendron there, you probably want to get rid of that. And you also want to prune as well. Pruning's what you do throughout the life cycle of a tree normally to make sure you don't... Well, it just helps with the quality of the timber and makes it more valuable if you prune it. So manage that management, and then just harvesting. So in that scenario, you're just wiping it down or cutting the whole forest down, and then it's actually a bit more... you have different types of clear felling as well, so this is shelter woods, and you have sometimes you leave trees to create seeds or to help regeneration. But it's very much you don't have... also in the system, you also have homogeneous monocultures of trees, and it's generally not very good for biodiversity or as a habitat. It's pretty insensitive. Continuous cover forestry is much more environmentally sensitive, and this can also be economical if you're managing it properly. So there was... continuous cover still requires some management. You still want to make sure that you have enough light getting through to the ground, so that you have a plant regenerate, or trees that can still come up and not get too much shade. For example, squash pine is quite a fairly light demanding species, so you do need light to get through to the ground, and if you don't have that, then your continuous cover forestry isn't going to be successful. So to try and assist in CCF, there's actually a PhD student, and next PhD student is now a lecturer at Newcastle, Rachel Gorton, and her work involved trying to quantify the structural parameters of a stand to see if CCF, or to monitor the success of CCF. And she developed her processing LiDAR to sort of quantify the gaps in the canopy and see where they are, and checking the forest in the gaps is quite important. Especially in this country, it's important to keep an eye on it, because you do need to still have intervention, some kind of management, due to the pressures from browsers such as deer, rabbits, hares, and invasive species like rhododendron make it very difficult for light-demanding trees to grow successfully. LiDAR, I didn't even explain it, sorry. LiDAR is light detection and ranging. It's basically just a laser pulse of light, which is normally at 64 nanometers. And instead of looking at just the reflectance of it would be handed up. You're interested in the time it takes for different parts of the, or the light's response. So at the top of the tree, you end up with a few photons reflecting there, and then at different layers of the tree, you have a certain number of photons bouncing back, and in the ground, you have either the rest absorbed or reflected. So it allows you to see the top of the canopy, the bottom, the ground, and bits in between it. And normally what you do with LIDAR is create a canopy height model, and it looks a bit like this. I didn't put legends on any of them actually, but the red is the ground and the blue is high up, so I think it's about 35 meters or something. So you can get you can see the height of pretty much any tree really accurately as well, in terms of spatial resolution and height. And below you also have the digital elevation model, which is just the final return that you get from the LIDAR pulse. With the canopy height model, that you can calculate timber volume from this just based on the tree height, and if you know the species as well. It's actually, in addition to the canopy height model, you can also calculate things like the canopy length, the width, and the tree height is the canopy height model, and you also have stand density. So from this you get canopy closure, and you also can calculate for the forests that you can work out the competition factor as well. So all these bits of information you can get from the slider data set. And although it is relatively expensive at the moment, there's a trial going on at the moment in Aberfoyle, so they have historical data going back to 2002. Every other year or so, they've done LIDAR surveys here. And you can, if you have a time series of this, it's really good for picking out. You can look at the growth in individual trees due to the accuracy of them. And such as with that, you can see when you think you might harvest the stand, or when the value of it as well. So it's really quite a lot of information. This is a site, Forestry Commission site, and you can see the boundaries here of the subcompartment database. And it would normally line up quite well with the edges or the boundaries of the stand itself, but this is an area which is on the worst end of accuracy by their standards. You can see quite a lot of... This is a LIDAR data set from 2011 or 2012, and subcompartment databases also from 2012, and it should have been updated till then, up to then. And you can see quite a lot of the boundaries don't line up. So there's work undertaken by my co-supervisor Juan Suarez at Forestry Commission and his colleagues to see if it's feasible to update the boundaries in this way using LIDAR, and as well calculate things like site index and yield class, which is normally specified when the site index should be known for specific sites, but it's often wrong. And this kind of data set will give you a really good site index. It will help you plan what is suitable to plant on the site, to see if trees are perhaps in areas suffering from drought, or if there's areas which might be waterlogged or doesn't have good soil drainage. And so you give this to a forester and it's really useful. You can see like a lot of different things going on in the forest there, which you wouldn't be able to see with regular optical imagery, nor just visiting a stand. You can't go around measuring every single tree, the height of every single tree every year or something. So is really useful. Let's move on to something completely different. So this is just overview of diseases in conifer. I just think it's incredible how many different types of diseases you have for different native and non-native species here, and the list just keeps getting longer every year. The tall ones at the top are ones on our zone, France, Spain, on the border, and they're expected to arrive in the next few years. And this is just conifer species. You get into broadleaf species, and there's tons and tons of, well, there's loads of diseases, and there's only going to be more of them coming. And for each one of these diseases, it's not the same management solution that if you have, for example, dothostroma in Scots pine, or if you have Lophodermion, they have two different routes you normally take in terms of managing the disease depending on environmental conditions at the site, etc. So this, just to outline, so when we're thinking of taking this tremor sensing, you need to understand what happens to what responses you get in a tree when it's hit by a disease. And these are some of the main ones. You normally get the breakdown of the first synthetic mechanism. You get a response in terms of the pigments or antioxidants in the leaf or needle. You also have changes in fluorescence as a result of the breakdown of the photosynthetic mechanism. And if the leaf or needle can't process or can't handle, sorry, the light it's taking in, it will produce reactive oxygen species which will destroy the plant from inside. Sometimes that can be a good thing if it's trying to, sometimes reactive oxygen species are actually used by the plant to try and destroy a disease if it thinks it's going to be useful. So in terms of detecting a disease, there's five non-destructive ways you can try and see, try and detect stress in trees. So the first one's kind of unconventional. It's certain fibers and filters you can use to try and for specific fungal diseases or stress. So signals from a tree, certain volatile compounds you get, and this is from a tree in response to stress sometimes. Visual examination, which is probably the most accurate and useful, because you can pick out things like cankers, which you aren't going to see in remote sensing. You can look at patterns in the way the pigmentation is happening in the leaf. It's nothing pizza. However, it's fairly impractical, especially if you've got trees that are 10, 15, 20 meters. It's quite difficult to access the canopy, and you really can't investigate every tree. You've got a huge forest. So for remote sensing, you have three main different ways of doing this. There's fluorescence measurements. However, it's very difficult to measure fluorescence from a distance. So at the moment, it's not actually possible to have a plane or UAS flying over, and it can take fluorescence measurements directly. You can figure it out indirectly through optical reflectance measurements, but optical reflectance measurements themselves, normally that's just RGB, so it's the regular camera or regular aerial image. However, you can split up the wavelengths of light and measure reflectance at specific wavelengths, and normally, actually I'll get into this later. And then the other method you have is thermal infrared measurements, so that's just calculating the temperature of the canopy. And when a tree is stressed, normally it closes stomata, or it will create extra, or it will dissipate the light energy into heat, and it will also not release much water, so it's transpiring less, so it's not releasing too much latent heat. So optical reflectance So on the left, you see the solar spectrum, and most light coming in is between the wavelengths of the wavelengths that we see, so blue to red. And that's what plants make use out of, is the radiation there. And you can see some hand-drawn spectra. When I say spectra, it's just the lines going like this, showing what reflectance is for a specific wavelength. And absorption is basically the opposite of reflectance in this scenario. So you have a lot of pigments absorbing a red and blue, which is why plants look green, because that's what they're reflecting most of. Now you can take advantage of the fact that different different pigments absorb more at different wavelengths of light. And this is just an example of what you have when you have a really diseased and a really healthy, these are Scots pine needles actually. This works for any foliage. You have an increase in reflectance in this way. An increase in reflectance that in the red wavelength is a result of chlorophyll breaking down, and you also have a decrease in near infrared reflectance as a result of the cell structure breaking down. And normally that is quite commonly used in a spectral index called the normalized difference vegetation indices. Very common use of monitoring vegetation with optical reflectance. So this is great for when you already have a plant that's already felt the effects of a disease or a stress such as drought or whatever, and you can quite easily look at where you have dead or dying leaves or needles. However, there is another pigment called zeaxanthin, which exists in around the photosynthetic mechanism, and it's used by plants to release, sort of to convert light energy to heat energy quickly, so that it doesn't end up with too many reactive oxygen species and the needle or the cell dies. And this particular changes in this particular pigment cause changes at specific wavelength of light, which is 531 nanometers. So you can see where that is on the reflectance spectrum, and this is the change with time. So this is a sunflower leaf in response to excess light. So a very simple stress on the plant. And this response happens very quickly, and you can measure it quite accurately by using the reference wavelength at 531 and another wavelength, which is fairly close to the original wavelength, so you don't get things like background effects or changes in illumination conditions affecting your measurements. Yeah, that's the 570 nanometer reference band, which is normally used. And so to take these measurements, you'll want to have a way of measuring light at the wavelengths in a very narrow band. If you have a regular RGB thing, a regular RGB sensor, your bands are going to be 50, 60 nanometers wide, which is going to cover too much of the spectrum. So you normally have to use special hyperspectral images or sensors. This thing down here is the field spectrometer, and that thing is a hyperspectral imager, and that's going to be put on a plane, and it will take measurements at these very narrow wavelengths of light. And from this you can calculate, I didn't mention before, the photochemical reflectance index is what this is called, with the using the 531 nanometer band. So that will be on an aeroplane. However, these instruments, the problem with taking measurements at such a narrow wavelength with light is you end up with the not enough light reaching the sensor normally, so you either have to have very sensitive instruments or one that has is looking at a larger area of the ground so it can collect more light. So for example, the only the highest resolution hyperspectral satellites sensors that you get are 30 meters because it's just very difficult to get enough light at such a small wavelength for it to pick up a signal, which is why they're being, you normally have them on an airborne platform. So in terms of stress detection in forestry, it's very difficult using this method to actually pinpoint what the cause of the stress is. However, with the time series, it allows you just to pick out when a stress might start occurring. And based on that, if you know a bit more about the forest or the potential diseases it could get, it could allow you to maybe perhaps figure out what is causing the stress in the tree. And it also allows you to send someone out to the forester to figure out what perhaps is causing it. And it saves a lot of risk. I mean, it's an expensive thing to do at the moment, flying the imager over an area. Well, if you have a large forest, it can be worthwhile because you're never going to be able to survey tall trees and not going to be able to survey the whole stand without doing it from above. And this brings me to the next slide, unmanned aircraft. And aircraft systems. These are small drones, effectively. They have small and lightweight payloads, and they're much easier to fly than an aircraft. You still need to be qualified as a pilot to fly these things. A different kind of pilot, but you still need to be qualified nonetheless. Much cheaper, easier to fly. So eventually, when these hyperspectral images get smaller and lighter in size, they'll probably be flown things like this, not aircraft. And this is, well, this kind of drone is, it costs about £10,000-£12,000, I believe, and it's fairly cheap to run, and it's also, if it breaks, it's actually one of the, so it's something that's actually quite easy to fix as well. It's plastic. And if it's cracks or something, you can normally fix it quite easily. All it has in the middle there is a small regular digital camera that takes high res. I think more than 12 megapixels or something like that. It's upgradable. The heaviest thing on there is actually the battery. It weighs about 1.1 kilos in total, and this one that's used by someone in Ireland at the Dumfries and the Galloway office, Forestry Commission, I think. Okay, so this is an example of the imagery that you get from a UAS. It's really, really high resolution. So you compare it to what's been used before to see what's going on in the stand. This kind of resolution imagery, you can really see whether there's problems with rhododendron or water. I don't know specifically why this light was flown, but it was the regular aerial imagery that existed before, the one on the left, wasn't sufficient, and this one definitely is. And there's another flight which was flown, and this one, the landowner wants to know something about something about this area here. He was trying to plant some stand or see what's happening there. I can't tell if it's already been planted or not. It looks like it's been planted. But it also covers this area on the left, the Windthrown area, and it's a close-up of it. So this was actually used and given to the contractors, and they were able to tell from this that the logs were much better, the timber quality was much better than they thought, and it was in lines in such a way that made it really easy for the machines to get through there and get them to the forwarders and get the logs out of there. And as a result of this, it saved about £2,000-£3,000 of the cost of getting it halves of taking out all of the logs here. So it's going to become probably very economical to start using UAS in forestry. There are some limitations at the moment, such as steep terrain or gusts of wind, which prevent it from flying, but it's a lot easier than flying aircraft, and I can see this being used at all stages in forestry in the UK. It makes everything a lot easier in terms of managing a forest if you're a landowner. It's going to become a very attractive way of doing forestry. So that's it. Thank you. I hope you have questions.
Thank you very much. Some nice examples in there. I was reading something recently about sort of patronising top-down view of people looking at landscapes and not asking the people within them what's actually going on. So it's nice to see that there are uses indeed for taking an overview. Questions?
Obviously, in terms of using your UAVs, problems I understand with them is flight time. For an area that is a reasonable size forest, can you give us some ideas to what the survey time is?
Yeah.
You might have to bring it back, charge it up, send it out again, compared to just flying standard plane over it.
That is actually the main limitation. At this particular device can fly for 30. I think it's 35 to 40 minutes, and it will cover an area like this. I actually don't know how many hectares that is, but quite a few. So, I don't know, I think they haven't, it's just a regular lithium phosphate battery. I think they can replace that if they need to do a few areas on one day. But that's the kind of technology which is advancing, quite fast battery technology. And this particular device, I think, is two years old or something. So probably already there's a model which can do twice the flight time. It's the main payload on this system is the battery itself. I can see that. Well, hopefully. These things are getting better all the time. It's becoming very, very popular at the moment. In the past 2-3 years, those people are using them now. Especially in precision agriculture, this is going to make it become precision forestry as well.
Any idea how much roughly it costs per hectare or kilometre?
This a day of for them to go and do a survey like this, they charge I think £700 or £800, which actually you can have a flight of a plane time for about the same amount. It's not bad. It depends what use you want it for. If you could know how many hectares that is to figure out sort of the price per hectare.
In this drawing, how do you know where it's pointing environments with a shift focus of hundreds of pictures.
It's an awesome usage process, so it takes, actually, yeah, a picture of like of it, but it just takes a lot of pictures continuously, and there's a program which will merge them all together so that it's just using the sensor from each picture and stitching them together. I don't think there's a proper IMU initial thing on the UAS. Just it has a regular GPS, and it, all the time it's communicating with the computer on the ground. So the images are stored on the camera, but the GPS information is transmitted to the computer. I think that is, as well as the GPS, it must be something else that's telling it whether it's is pointing somewhere else. But the software that stitches them together looks at different features in the photo. So it knows, just by looking at the photo normally, where the alignment is between photo and photo. It will know the order that took the photos in. It will look for patterns between each photo and line them up that way. It's not that complex. With regular author rectification on taken from airborne imagery, it's a lot more complex normally. But because it's just continuously taking photos and it's just looking for patterns and stitching them. That's all it's doing.
What sort of vertical accuracy?
You can use it to take a... You're talking about the height from the...
Yeah.
It's not being used... But this one isn't actually being used to work out vertical accuracy, but it can be... For this particular system, they make you send all the information to the manufacturers, and then they can figure out what the vertical... Yeah. They can make a... It figures out the 3D structure of the lens, but yeah, I wouldn't know what the vertical accuracy is nor how it would be. You normally use LiDAR for the.
Yeah, before John talks about forest management, if you look at ownership patterns across Europe, inland Europe. Communities own forests a lot, whereas in Scotland, for example, very few communities own forests. Do you think with these types of tools, it's more realistic for communities to own forests and manage them effectively?
I think so. There's only one community I know in Scotland, well, personally, I guess, that owns a forest, and they could. I mean, communities normally actually, they're not so interested in making it economical. Is that just an opinion, or it's more just to do something that's good for the environment?
There's a community in Mull that's setting up a forestry there, and that's commercial.
Is it? But if it's commercial, then they would be interested. I think any commercial forestry should be interested in these systems potentially. It makes it easier if it's a huge forest that they own as well, because if it's a relatively small forest, it might as well do land surveys. But if you've got old trees, young trees, and it's a large area of land that you own, it's economical. I think it's economical to have one of these. I wouldn't see why. Community woodland owners would be any more or less inclined to use this than sort of private landowners. It tends to be more political than the law. I don't know how community woodland owners really manage their forests. Whether they're also interested in the environmental aspects, in which case they'll probably want to move towards the more continuous cover, selective thinning type sort of quadrupole system. But UAS is still very useful in those kinds of scenarios as well.
I remember at a previous talk about UAVs, somebody mentioned, the speaker mentioned that the Civil Aviation Authority had been a little bit concerned about the, obviously some new technologies, the regulations haven't been set in stone, haven't been around for as long as conventional aircraft, and the CAA at the time had imposed some fairly strict regulation with regards to things like flight ceilings and the line of sight and things like that. Is that something you see they'll get more relaxed as more and becomes a more accepted technology, or as more and more users get used and become strict or stay about the same level of construction?
The last I've heard a couple of months ago about it was that the CAA wants to be more relaxed about the regulations over UAS technology. Things like the line of sight I don't see being relaxed too much, but that isn't one of the main, I don't think it's one of the main concerns with US technology. It's normally trying to fly to a location which might be near a particular building or something which they don't want, or area where they don't want you flying there. I'm actually not too sure what the main restrictions are that prevent this being used in forestry scenarios. But at the moment, it's actually fine to have these things flying. It's probably there's certain areas which you can't fly near, where there'll be forests, which there may be forests. The last I've heard, the CAA wants to make the regulations more relaxed for this technology. But I'm not sure how long that will take or how much more relaxed I'll make it.
So, as a forest I can surely see the use of the UAV, and I can really see in the future being able to measure a lot of things. I was just wondering, because this is actually just a sample, a small sample of a bigger area. So outside of the picture, we have more forests, obviously. So when you do inventory, usually we have more broad goals. So you're trying to measure, for instance, deviation height, and you're trying to extrapolate, so you're doing a lot of sampling. So I was just wondering, since this is just a small sample, how long before we will be able to use those UAVs in order to sample the whole forest? Because that's the interesting part. Because what you have there is just a small sample of a bigger area. So you're targeting where you're going to sample that way. So you cannot actually say something for the whole forest, you can say something for a small area. So I was just wondering how much time it's going to take for the UAVs to take over.
I think this is slightly related to Bruce's point earlier, which is just these things are really restricted by battery life at the moment. So if the battery life was 4 or 5 times what was powerful, you'd be able to cover an area 4 or 5 times this. But at that point, at the moment, when you're looking at a forest level, it's just as economical to fly a regular plane over it. And with that kind of system, you also have the option of doing better kind of imagery, the hyperspectral imagery, which will give you a bit more information about the forest itself. But obviously, if you're a forest owner and you want to do it yourself, you'll want to fly your own UAS. And I think it's just a matter of 3-4 years before these things get an area 10 times this covered. I think it's more a matter of time than anything else before you start seeing these things being able to cover forest level scale.
Can we go back to the LiDAR? Because as an archaeologist, obviously, I'm interested in the effective use of LiDAR within forested areas. And I was just wondering, within the work that foresters use with LiDAR, do they ever integrate this with archaeological imagery? Because forests are particularly effective areas, both historic forests and man-created forests, for the preservation of archaeological sites. So you get well-preserved archaeological sites within forests. And I just wonder, what you've shown us is some, you know, I think probably the better standard uses of LIDAR with the forestry contracts, but when people are working on this, are they aware also that there are other aspects that the LIDAR will also record or could record, potentially record?
I think the people who are using this data are probably not aware of that too much. But they probably should be, and there's certainly lots of woods in Scotland which I know of, but, especially in the, Highlands, but no ones in the Highlands with good archaeological features.
What do you say to the Forestry Commission? Do you have an archaeologist embedded in the company and in the organisation? A number of you don't use the LIDAR for the archaeological organisation.
Well, yeah, there's a national, I think there's LIDAR. Almost at the moment, I think there's LIDAR for almost every place in the UK now. So there might be someone who's using this national data set. And to be honest, once you've taken a LIDAR survey of a place once, which is high enough quality, it doesn't matter too much if you do it again and again. Because, for example, the four times they've done LIDAR at the site in Aberfoyle, I mean, you calculate the EM, but it's just the same thing. There's not much happening on the ground itself. As long as the archaeological features are not changing in any way, you're going to capture that information once with one LIDAR survey. And I think there's LIDAR data which covers the whole of the UK at the moment. So it's probably just a matter of sifting through all that information. It's incredibly detailed, so it takes a lot of time to go through it if you're looking for the archaeological features.
Just be careful where you send the lorries in.
Yeah.